rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen im Falter Radio. Unter Joe Biden überrascht und enttäuscht Amerika zugleich. Die wirtschaftspolitischen Pläne des amerikanischen Präsidenten sind progressiver, als viele erwartet haben. 1,9 Billionen Dollar sollen in die Belebung der Wirtschaft gehen, fast 4 Billionen in die marode Infrastruktur. Seit dem New Deal unter Franklin D. Roosevelt hat keine amerikanische Regierung so viel staatliche Investitionen geplant wie die Administration von Joe Biden. Ende September werden die letzten Details im Kongress in Washington ausgehandelt. Außenpolitisch betont Biden den Multilateralismus, was die Europäer freut, aber in Afghanistan ist der Rückzug der amerikanischen Streitkräfte denkbar chaotisch abgelaufen. Die Europäer waren nicht wirklich eingebunden. Wie schwer die Niederlage für die Weltmacht Amerika ist, sickert nur langsam in das kollektive Bewusstsein. Jeffrey Sachs ist ein führender internationaler Ökonom. Er unterrichtet an der Columbia University in New York und hat mehrere Bücher und Studien über den Kampf gegen die Armut in der Welt verfasst. In der Zeit des Umbruchs von der Sowjetunion zum heutigen Russland war Jeffrey Sachs Berater von Boris Jelzin. Im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum war Sachs virtueller Gast von Robert Miesig. Miesig hat zuerst nach den Auswirkungen des Afghanistan-Debakels für die Biden-Administration gefragt. Jeffrey Sachs sieht die afghanische Erfahrung im größeren Zusammenhang.
The U.S. has been in an internal crisis for years, actually. The Trump period was a crisis. He was a mentally unstable individual and a deeply divided political system. We hoped with the arrival of Joe Biden, who is a sane and rational and a nice man also and very experienced, that things would calm down. That's not quite happened. The politics remains deeply divided. Of course, our upper house, the Senate, is at a 50-50 split. The lower house, the House of Representatives, is nearly 50-50. We don't have government in the same sense as a parliamentary system. So Democrats don't necessarily vote for the president, for example. Biden is having a hard time passing critical legislation or finding the consensus. The Senate is even more complicated because there is the procedure of filibuster, which allows a minority to block a majority vote, requiring a supermajority of 60 votes to end a debate. And for technical reasons, certain kinds of things can be passed by a straight majority, and there will be such an occasion later this month. For many other things, the filibuster effectively blocks the president from acting. Now, add up the deep divisions, the policy difficulties, the COVID pandemic, the cultural divides in the U.S., where we have a full anti-vax movement. We have a very populistic group of governors, for instance, the governors of Texas and Florida, who have avidly fought against any kind of public health measures to contain COVID. We've had a massive surge of COVID this summer. Then add in Afghanistan. So Afghanistan was a bad idea in 1979 when the CIA started its covert operations in Afghanistan. After all, the U.S. created and funded the Mujahideen, which became Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. This is the dirty little secret that no one in U.S. public life wants to talk about, but those jihadists are the creation of the United States to a significant extent. Then came the invasion in 2001 and 20 years in Afghanistan. Then came the withdrawal, which absolutely was needed, but God, was botched in every way, almost unimaginably poorly planned, and failure of anticipation of the complete collapse of that U.S.-backed regime. Well, what does all of this add up to, Robert, in my view? First, any idea, and it still is prevalent in Europe with hopes that the U.S. is the leader somehow of the North Atlantic, is a little bit naive. I've been saying that for years, and not only as an opponent of Trump, but simply the idea that the U.S. leads constructively in the world is already, sad to say, an exaggeration. I just hope the U.S. cooperates, that it's normal at one point or another. But the U.S. can't lead because we're too divided to lead, too much incompetence, unfortunately, throughout government, because it's been weakened for quite a long time. And so Afghanistan was a very visible, perhaps shocking sign of that for those around the world, but not a surprise to me. Of course, a surprise in the literal sense. But if you had asked me, is the U.S. incompetent? I would have said yes, easily. For we've had 630,000 COVID deaths, for God's sake. That is complete incompetence. Awful. So what happened in Afghanistan showed the world more of what's happening in the United States. It's not easy. It's not good. The drama continues, and we're just in the middle of it.
You talked about that it was poorly planned. I assume this is also that we have to. This is also a problem we have to add to Joe Biden, who was in charge in the last months, but the withdrawal was with the Taliban. The talks, they were during the Trump administration, and Biden now in some ways says he couldn't do anything more because with these troops on the ground, there was no possibility for him to do it the other way. And he also says that it was okay to leave. And my impression is this is one of the things the American right and the American left is they are on a common ground, because both think that it was okay to leave and that there is no place for America and U.S. should not fight wars at the end of the world. Do you think this is a common ground now in the United States, in a way, a little bit of isolationism?
Well, first, I wouldn't call this isolationism because there are so many dimensions of international engagement in international life. The U.S. has sanctions regimes all over the world. The U.S. is in one way, positively or negatively, engaged all over the world. There is certainly among the American people just an exhaustion of a large number of stupid wars. We've been fighting Iraq twice. We had the Afghan war, which again, remember, goes back to the 1980s, not just the 2000s. We had the U.S. covert, not so covert, engagement in Syria. We had NATO in Libya also ended in, or didn't end, and just produced more chaos and debacle. So there is, in American opinion, probably 70% of the public that has enough of this. This isn't working. Now, at the and Trump also, I could not stand almost anything about that man. I just have to emphasize, but he did want to get out of Afghanistan, and I agreed with him on that. Although on almost nothing else about him or by him, it's kind of interesting that after spending $1 trillion, by some counts $2 trillion, I'll go with the conservative number of $1 trillion. The Trump administration negotiated with the Taliban without even including the Afghan government. That already is weird, you know. So that's a setup for any kind of failure. Then announcing fixed dates and saying we're just getting out no matter what is another kind of setup for failure. The truth is, we put in $1 trillion or $2 trillion in Afghanistan without any real knowledge of or care for Afghanistan or its society or its complexities or its government. It was a very, if you could be superficial with $1 trillion, that's what we were. It was weird. Of course, more than 900 billion of that trillion just went for the military, went for armaments, went for U.S. troops, went for the Afghan army. We never really cared about Afghanistan per se. And Biden takes it as a mark of honor. I think it's a kind of shame the way we talk about it. But, oh, we don't believe in nation building. That's actually an emblem of pride among American politicians, that we're there only because of us. We're not there because of them. We're not so stupid as to be engaged in nation building. Well, what is it when you occupy another country for 20 years, you spend it $2 trillion, and you pronounce care about you? You have to understand, you are irrelevant. We are here because maybe China. We are here maybe because of Iran. We are here maybe because of terrorists. But you don't think of it. Why would we waste our time on you? And this is American foreign policy parlance. And it is a reflection also of the fact that America is a pretty Islamophobic society, not everywhere, but with a significant part. So what are we doing all over the Middle East? We're hating those people, a large part of American society. Well, they know it. So how can we find stability on the ground? How could we build governance when there is an underlying cultural disdain by a significant part of America for the country that we're occupying or that we're attacking or that we're bombing? And this is just a completely miscast role. And it is a general weakness of American foreign policy that Trump made completely vulgar. If a country says, we are first, that's it, we don't really care about anyone else, this is just about us. In fact, if you have a slogan, America first, you don't win a lot of friends, you don't have a lot of diplomatic influence, you don't really find common ground for problem solving. You turn out to be distrusted, disliked, even hated, an easy target. Well, the U.S. brings it on itself. I find it very sad.
We could talk a lot about the Afghanistan situation and also what you called the mockery about nation building, because it's also wrong. We were a little bit proud that we have universities, that we have young women in schools and universities in Afghanistan. What should that be if not nation building and the building of a democratic, pluralistic society with an idea of a better future for this society? But why we also in Europe and the progressives especially are a little bit we are looking at the situation is because we hope that the Biden administration, or some of us will hope that the Biden administration has success, because for the economic and the global, let's say, political philosophical debate, we had the impression in the spring that this is a bold start of this president. I mentioned some figures, this 1.9 trillion emergency program, the $2.3 trillion American jobs plan with infrastructure and fight against climate change, this $1.8 trillion American family plan, schools, childcare, etc. We had the impression that this president is much more progressive than we expected. Actually, I think as a newspaper wrote in Germany, the President Biden is much more left than the senator ever was. So we were a little bit astonished. How would you comment on that? Is this a really shift in paradigm?
Well, again, the challenge in the United States is that one cannot understand the American political system like a parliamentary system. In a parliamentary system, there's a government that has a majority, and the government is in power as long as it can keep the majority. In the United States, we have something that is a lot messier. So we have a president who is directly or semi-directly elected, because we also have the intervening electoral college. Then we have the two houses of Congress, and we have the 50 states, and we have the Supreme Court. And the situation in the United States is right now deeply divided and rather chaotic in almost every sphere. The president may propound something, but getting that through any of our processes, whether it's even regulatory process within the executive branch or the legislative process, navigating a deeply divided House and Senate, or withstanding the attacks in the courts, which are relentless, facing governors that are claiming their prerogatives. The situation in the U.S. is that there can be no decisive turns right now, because there's no decisive underlying cultural or political consensus. And the political system, even when there is a consensus in public opinion, won't find a consensus in votes, because our political system is also highly corrupted by money. The 2020 election cycle was about $14 billion of campaign financing. Think of how much money that is to buy votes. So I'll give you an example now. President Biden, whom I like a lot, and the Senate Budget Committee, Senator Sanders, who I supported in his run for president, have put forward a bold 10-year strategy of reforms with a $3.5 trillion 10-year price tag. Now, that is a lot of money, but also I hasten to say that since the U.S. economy is large, it's only a little bit above 1% of GDP per year. So I wouldn't call it a fiscal revolution, but I would call it an important step forward.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In order to implement that, the government needs to win a vote on raising taxes to pay for this. Now, the Democratic Party ostensibly is the party of the center left and should want our deeply undertaxed society to raise taxes in order to fund anti-poverty programs, anti-hunger programs, public infrastructure, greening of the economy, and so on. But what we are seeing is that significant part of the Democratic Party is more plutocratic than progressive. And not surprisingly, they themselves are often millionaires, but they, more importantly even, they go out for campaign contributions to millionaires and billionaires in the corporate sector. And so Biden has no sure way to secure his party's vote. And we are within a couple of weeks of at least trial votes on this. And it's a quite uncertain situation. Centrist Democrats, so-called, are saying, don't raise taxes so much. I can tell you as an economist, the wealthy in the United States are wealthier beyond anything seen in the history of the world. We have a $200 billion billionaire, Jeffrey Bezos. But we have a number of mega billionaires who have paid almost nothing in tax along the way. We have companies that have soaring profits and soaring stock market prices and CEOs that are making $20, $40, $50, $100 million a year in compensation, basically paying almost nothing in tax. And yet, even then, the Republicans are completely against tax increases. I mean, to every vote. And every vote, I mean, it's unbelievable. And the Democrats are divided. So all of this is to say, even with the arrival of a president that is espousing progressive lines, how far the U.S. gets on anything is an open question. And I'm fearful, like most people on the center left or the left, in 2022, by historical norm, though not by any determinism, the party in the White House tends to lose seats in Congress. And so those tiny margins for the Democrats in the Congress could be lost in one or two houses, in which case there will be no more legislation of any progressive kind after 2022. And then given our instability, given the pervasive racism in parts of American society, the extreme populism, shockingly disgusting governors that we have in many states, like DeSantis in Florida and Abbott in Texas, who knows where we're heading. So we're still lurching. We're lurching week to week, month to month. This is not a government. It is a president. It's a divided country. We are in the midst of all of these divisions right now. In the meantime, with the pandemic, with the variants of concern arising, with global challenges largely unmet. So there are talented people in the administration who I like enormously. I like the president very much, and I'm holding my breath to see what he can get through the political process.
This doesn't sound too much optimistic to put it in an ironic way, but to a very naive question, maybe you don't have necessarily the tax to spend. And especially this, you are right, these long time spending plans, the American job plan, the American family plan, the infrastructure plans, they need a legislative process. But what if they are financed by debt? I think infrastructure projects that bring people to jobs, they might be popular also in a broader audience or people, voters. And could this be a possibility for Biden to win over at least the public opinion in a broader sense, and not only the 50% of the of this 50-50 split America?
Well, there are two issues here. One, the economics issues around that, and second, the political issues around that. On a purely practical point, the claim of one of the key Democrats in the Senate, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, is he won't vote for large budget deficits. And without his vote, there's no majority to pass the legislation. So there's just a very pragmatic point that the administration could not get through a large deficit financed increment beyond what we have right now. Then there's the economic point. And the economic point is roughly the following. The U.S. Total tax revenues as a share of national income is around 30% right now, whereas in Europe, on average, in the EU, it's about 45%. So the U.S. is profoundly undertaxed. That's pretty much across the board. One thing we don't have at all at the federal level is a VAT. So we lose several percentage points of not having a VAT. But our payroll tax collection, our income tax collection, our corporate tax collection tends to be lower than in Europe. So we're running a society that is short of revenues by as much as 15% of GDP. I think if you think in Austria, what it would be like to lop off 15% of GDP on the revenue side, it would be a very different society. And it would be struggling all fronts with infrastructure, with poverty, with inequality, with social relief, with healthcare. Well, the U.S. is struggling on all those fronts. But the U.S. has a very particular political culture. We grew up in this aura of economic freedom that was defined already by John Locke, in essence, as don't tax me. And so we grew up as a tax revolt society. That was the reason for separating from England, after all, was against taxes. So it was a tax revolt. And that rhetoric of anti-tax is a pervasive rhetoric. It temporarily went away in the Great Depression and World War II because government needed the revenues. The public supported that. But since Reagan became president in January 20th, 1981, so 40 years ago, this anti-tax sentiment has been absolutely a core feature of politics. What Biden is trying to do, what Bernie Sanders is trying to do, what the Democrats are claiming to do is to say, you know, we should tax the rich and the corporations so that we can have social policies and green infrastructure. So that, to my mind, is both absolutely correct, but a hard sell. Then comes the question, economically, if you could do it, which we can't politically, but economically, should we just have debt financing? And the fact of the matter is the U.S. debt has soared as a share of national income over the last 40 years during this tax cutting period, because the public actually doesn't want the spending cut. It just wants the taxes cut. So we've lived with this contradiction since Reagan. Tax cuts, oh, budget deficit gets larger. Well, we can't really cut the spending. Maybe we'll partially restore some of the tax cuts. You do that enough times, and then with enough wars, maybe $6 trillion of spending on wars that we talked about, We now have a debt to GDP ratio that is around 102% of GDP, and it's the highest since the end of World War II, which was a partially debt-financed war. So we're at a historic high of the debt to GDP ratio, and that doesn't even take into account that Social Security, our pension system, is not fully funded. Actuarially, we're way behind proper funding. So we need higher taxes in the future, but in a population and in a culture that doesn't want to wear face masks, that doesn't want to get vaccines, and that doesn't want to pay taxes, because all of that is freedom. This is what makes America a really strange place.
This sounds a little bit desperate, for sure. And there are some good reasons to be desperate, I can understand. But on the other hand, people said that a president who is so much in the center, and nobody assumes he's a radical, has better possibilities to change a little bit the minds of the broad public opinion, and also that the progressive economists won in a way the debate in the last 20 years or 10 years. So we left this neoliberal consensus. Could these two elements together bring a little bit, and if it's only step to step and very step to step?
The answer is yes, definitely. There's a narrow path to sanity and normalcy. It really exists. I am not meaning to portray the end of American society or end of American democracy. I'm meaning to explain how fraught the situation is. But even in the next 2 weeks, Biden may win a big vote on a 50-50 even division in the Senate plus a tiebreaker. We don't know, even 2 weeks out, whether he can manage to hold his party together for something ambitious, but it's not impossible.
A vote on the infrastructural bill or what?
Called the reconciliation bill, that $3.5 trillion package that may change numbers sometime in the next couple of weeks, but Biden could have a significant win. It's really possible. In fact, people in the White House say, in the end, we'll find the way to hold Joe Manchin to our side and we'll get this vote done. I hope they're right. So this is one real possibility. Another reason for optimism is that the legislation is broadly popular. But in American politics, that's not the same thing as having it voted. Unpopular things get passed, like the 2017 corporate tax cut, and popular things get defeated routinely because money intervenes, because the institutions of our complicated so-called checks and balances government intervenes. But public opinion breaks 60-40 or even 65-35 in the right direction by my standards on almost every issue. So the battle is not against most of America. The battle is against, my political battle, if I could put it that way, Biden's political battle right now, is against 35 or 40% of public opinion, which translates into 50% of the votes in our two-party system. If we had a multi-party democracy, it would look a lot different in terms of likelihood of change. A third reason for change is that the younger generation is a lot more progressive-minded than the older generation. So Trump is a politics of older white people who watch Rupert Murdoch's Fox News. It's a part of America that has this extreme nationalism, the Islamophobia, the racism, the anti-government, the anti-tax. But the young generation is much more racially diverse, ethnically diverse, tolerant, and in general, more progressive politically. So all of that, you would say, if you step back, if things don't explode, we could find a path to a much better situation. And I want to emphasize that I'm not speaking in a measure of desperation, but really a lot of worry about the short term. A lot of things can go wrong. And to emphasize how divided the U.S. is and how it will be divided culturally and politically for several years to come. But even in that context, Biden could make some significant wins. And lo and behold, he could even carry the 2022 elections. And then all that I'm saying would look passé because things would look a lot brighter after that.
My last question to the elections of 2022, there is might be the possibility if a minority in the Senate or in the Congress in generally is blocking popular things, that senators that are blocking are voted out of office. Is this a possibility, or is it because of the electoral division not really a possibility?
I'm sorry, for the administration?
That the Democrats can also win the midterm elections if the conservatives block popular things. That might be not totally out of the possibility, or?
Absolutely. The 2022 elections are up for grabs. They are not fated. People who look to history say that the White House almost always lose seats in both houses, but nothing is guaranteed about that. There are exceptions, and 2022 could be an exception. It's just so darn consequential. Because if Biden loses even one of the two houses, the consequences in our current state of affairs almost surely would be dead set stalemate, with the idea of creating failure, actually, to create a change at the top of the White House election in 2024. It's a horrible thing.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But, you know, not completely unknown to politics, that the name of the game would be create a failed government or a failed administration. So we're close on all of this. It also means that during this period, all focus will be internal. It comes back to what I said at the beginning. Don't expect the U.S. to lead right now. And if the U.S. tries to lead, Biden will actually worsen his chances domestically. His best chances are to focus domestically, to avoid crisis globally, to not have a Cold War with China, for God's sake, to not have more international instability, but try to create a base of sense and decency at home and win the 2022 elections.
Sie hörten ein Gespräch mit dem amerikanischen Ökonomen Jeffrey Sachs, das Robert Miesig Mitte September im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum geführt hat. Beim Kreisky-Forum bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW zuhören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Aktuelle Diskussionen über wirtschaftspolitische Trends gibt es regelmäßig im Falter. Ein Abonnement des Falter ist ein guter Schritt, um informiert zu bleiben. Ein Falter-Abo kann man im Internet bestellen unter der Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet, Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.